Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. August 5th marks the six-year anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. The hate crime left six people dead and four others wounded, and the killer later committed suicide. Among those who died in the ambush was the temple's leader, Satwant Singh Kalika.
This weekend is a time of reflection for the entire Milwaukee community, but it holds a particular significance for Satwant's son, Pardeep Singh Kalika. The younger Kalika has tried to live up to his father's philosophy, working with Serve to Unite, an organization that teaches tolerance to young people. He also co-authored a book with former white supremacist Arno Michaelis.
But on today's show, Pardeep Kalika talks about his father's life, which began in the rural village of Dogal in the Punjab region of India, where Satwant was a farmer. Difficult times and violence led him to move to America to seek better opportunities with his wife and two young sons. Eventually, he came to lead the Sikh temple in Oak Creek.
Pardeep Kalika joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and recalled what life was like for his family when they first moved to Milwaukee.
It was difficult. You know, they worked for not much and quickly realized that there was no way to sustain living just one income. And so my mom had to go back to work. And I remember at that time I was probably about 6 years old, six or seven. And my younger brother was 4 or 5 years old. And it was really kind of up to us to watch each other's back. It was just a struggle and a battle to not only just make it in Milwaukee, but, you know, the culture of Milwaukee was also shifting at that time. And there was a lot of jobs that started to leave town. And that left a vacuum for you know, now you're replacing manufacturing legitimate income jobs for, you know, an illegal economy, kind of just a, because you couldn't survive. And I remember growing up trying to find places that were safe. So we moved around quite a bit from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood. And both my mom and dad were working. My mom was trying to learn English so she could get a job. And we would spend a lot of time at home just kind of watching TV and at the mercy of watching reruns of different shows and really not seeing faces that were similar to ours be anything. So idolizing those that did not look like us, it was difficult because then you're losing a little bit of yourself and your culture. And at that time, I mean, it was kind of common. People called it the melting pot. And it sure was, you know, a melting pot at that time as you lost a lot of yourself. And I just remember early on just really being, it being difficult, making friends in different places and trying to adjust. And I mean, I can look back at it now and say, okay, well, that was a blessing to be able to meet different faces. But at that time, I would oftentimes miss some of the friends that I would leave at the old apartment. And we went from the north side to the northwest side, to the west side, to West Dallas to South Milwaukee, to Oak Creek. And really, like, this whole journey has basically got me to the point that it's like, if we don't start to invest in all the neighborhoods that exist, we can't segregate violence. If we don't start to invest in all areas and start to see ourselves within an entire city, state, nation, no place is safe.
You mentioned you felt as if you were losing part of yourself. You're kind of living in split worlds, you know, still trying to connect and identify with American culture, yet at home you have the strict upbringing as well. One memory in your book relates to your father deciding to cut yours and your brother's hair after being bullied so badly in school for it. How did he come to that decision, and what do you think it's showed about him and his sacrifice and commitment to trying to establish this new life for all of you?
Yeah, that's a great question, Audrey. I know that it was a difficult decision for him. He was a very spiritual man, and anybody you talk to in town, he could basically read a passage and memorize a passage and tell you the passage. But he also was empathetic to the suffering of his children. He saw that we were coming home and we were crying and we were, you know, telling people that people are, and what we had at the time were Judas. At that time, the man bun wasn't a popular thing. And this was very much likened to a man bun covered by cloth. So people will go around and really like just tap you on the top of the head and, you know, and liken it to a buzzer in Jeopardy. then asking you questions like, what is under there? Well, it's my hair. Only girls wear hair like that. And so all of this was just kind of commonplace. So we would go home, and he wrote in his journal that that was one of the hardest days of his life, was to take us to the barber shop and have our hair cut. And I remember it was my brother's hair that he got cut first. I remember being a little bit envious of, like, why did he get to assimilate faster than I got to assimilate? Now that I look back at it, it kind of makes sense. He was trying to hold on and do it. Like, he couldn't take it all at one time.
It's kind of a testament to something so deeply important to him and his religion, and yet having to make these sacrifices and adjustments for the sake of making it a somewhat more tolerable experience. Yeah. Do you think your parents or father recognize that through this new life, you know, even though you kind of had to play both roles, hide the music you were listening to, or yeah, the friends you were hanging out with, or the girls you were dating who weren't Indian, do you think they saw this as later on just a strength that was added for you and your brother, that you got to have these dynamic experiences, even though it was hard for you growing up to have such a strict household, but yet outside of that household, it's a different American culture?
Yeah, no, it Audrey, it was hell. Growing up, it was literally hell, because you wore different masks. You wore an at-home mask when you were like, okay, well, let me just be kind of traditional, and I'll talk, you know, we'll talk this way and we'll talk that way. And, you know, out in public, it was kind of wearing this other mask of, well, I'm a boy, man, growing up in this culture, and now I got to be hard, and I got to be tough, and I gotta blend in. And yeah, and dating was just, it was difficult as well, because you couldn't tell your parents that I was dating someone. So I don't think they really thought of it as a strength at that time. They would have been like, you're trying to be too American. These kids don't know our culture, and it was just, you're caught in between different things. And now that I look back at it, say, okay, you know what? Some of what happened on August 5th was really reminding me to say, okay, you know what? You need to take your own voice back, whatever that voice is and whatever you're meant to be. You need to come back to that and take that voice back, because there's value in your culture being part of this culture.
You could, I suppose, say that your father was that centering force, that constant reminder of, this is your culture, this is who you are, where you came from. But how does his demeanor change towards you as, you know, you grew up and your relationship changed, you know, from childhood to teenage years and all the discipline and the hell that you went through to adulthood leading up to his death? You know, how did he know that he cared and loved and respected you?
Oh,
and vice versa, you know?
Yeah, no, so it was really, I mean, it was a journey with both my mom and my father. But for that part of, like, just knowing that somebody loved you, my mom was very much more nurturing than my father was. My father was the type, and I didn't understand this later, but he would kind of show you. I look back at it, and it makes complete sense now as a 42-year-old man who has children of my own. But at the time, each time I used to leave home for an extended period of time, like if I went to college, the day of, he would get into a heated argument with me. And I was like, why is this pattern always, like, as soon as I'm about to leave, he gets into this really just argumentative state of mind where we're both lashing out at one another. And over time, I realized that was his way of showing me that he was going to miss me. And he had to, like, prepare himself to be able to miss his son. And it's just a weird culture of masculinity that we were trying to navigate. But later on in life, once I had my own children, he would just do things, and these things would be just simply random. I would come home, and I would see him picking the weeds out of the flower bed. And now you have the 60-some-year-old man who's doing this, and he's kind of gleaming over at you and saying, okay, I see you haven't done this. So there was this part of, like, you haven't really won this fight. And for sons getting out of the shadow of their fathers, I think that there's always some fight. And he would just every once in a while do things to say, you know, the shadow might not be as bad as you think it is. My final day that I spent with my father was just a beautiful day. And it was August 3rd. It was my birthday. And this is 2 days before August 5th. So the last time that I saw my father, he was giving piggyback rides to our children. And he was just happy being a grandfather. He was always, because of how he grew up, and he didn't have a welcoming sort of culture for him to come into. His vision was to create that and create a community that other Sikhs could come to and worship with and assemble with and share, like just be welcomed, so that they don't have to sacrifice some of the culture that we had to sacrifice. But you know, he was very content where he was on August 3rd, and I could tell. And then just later on, we drank a little bit more and played with the kids, and there was this genuine, like, I respect the way that you did things, Dad, and I know that you respect the way that I'm doing things. And that would be our final sort of memory together, and it was a great one.
Your father had a favorite saying, work is worship, and you mentioned that farming was sacred work for him as well. And throughout his life, after he established himself here in Milwaukee, was building businesses, building the temple, and you mentioned he had this truck forever. Like, no matter how well he did or anything, like, he constantly rode that truck or was doing repairs himself, things like that. You know, do you think that was kind of a good example of who he was like kind of the character that he kept this truck around and just did everything by himself no matter how good things were going?
No, it definitely was. He never bought a new car. And at some point he had gotten to the point where he was financially capable to buy a new car or a house or, you know, what you name it, but he was financially capable of doing that. But he had so much of that humility from when we didn't have money that he would definitely do everything on his own. Whatever he could do, he would do on his own. That truck was actually a gift that I gave to him. It was beautiful. It had an 8-foot bed, which is perfect for, like, drywall, flooring, and all kinds of things, right? And so that truck is still, I mean, it's still in our family now. And it keeps running and keeps running and keeps running. But he was the type that he would work himself to sleep. There was times when he would be jackhammering. And now this man is 170 pounds. He's really wiry and super strong for, like, the size that he was. And he would never give up. He was like that, just that wiry sort of fence that, like, you just can't cut. It's like you just have. It's like almost a pain in the ass, but he would outwork you. He would outwork you. And there was days when he would work himself so hard that he fell asleep for 3 miles. And you get home and he's collapsed out again, taking ibuprofen. But he wanted to push you.
With the anniversary coming up, I imagine, of course, it's a somber time. But as the years pass on, you know, does your reflection of your father change with every anniversary?
Yeah, it does. Early on, I think as much as we were trying to put a brave face on for the world because we felt the responsibility to do so, it was very emotional. I mean, emotional to the point that it was hard to reflect on some of these good and bad memories. And, you know, when somebody loses somebody in that capacity, there's this sense of processing that needs to authentically happen. And for us, yes, we put, you know, but we were gritting our teeth through a lot of that. We were still mourning. We were still thinking that the world is unfair. Everybody is out to get us, against us. So there's this anxiety with it and all types of feelings that you have wrapped up in, you know, your emotional skin that you're processing through. So over time, it has very much become a journey of authentic healing. And it changes now because now, since his death, my wife at that time was 7 months pregnant. And my youngest two boys had never seen their grandfather. But they speak as if they know him. And they speak as if he's a friend. And I think there's something spiritual within us and within our DNA that lets them know and feel that he's still there. And there's mannerisms that they have that I know that they haven't picked up by seeing him move around, but they just have to be genetically encoded. And there's things that they say that he would have said. And there's this sense of, I guess, in myself, the sense of contentment and gratitude towards life being that way, that we can get to a point where we can really spiritually heal because we know that the person is not dead but has transitioned.
What would you like listeners to take away about your father and in their own reflections as this anniversary comes up?
Yeah, and I hope that people think about their own loss and their own story. Your story is an honor for someone to hear, and it's going to help somebody, and it really needs to be cherished. Over the past 6 years now, I have been inundated with stories of people suffering and stories of people's pain and you know, almost every type of mass shooting you can think of, from survivors from Columbine to Sandy Hook to children that grieve for their parents. And what I've learned throughout that time was, if you value that people share their story, then you can work through your own pain. If it's a burden for you to hear other people's stories and journeys and suffering, then somehow, some way, vicariously, you pick it up, because we're not honoring pain. And overall, I think this country needs to really accept and honor the pain of the past so that we can really heal going forward.
Pardeep Kalika is the eldest son of Satwant Singh Kalika, the president of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, who was murdered in the mass shooting that took place at the temple on August 5th, 2012.
Kalika is also the co-author of Gift of Our Wounds and co-founder of the organization Serve to Unite. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can hear more of their conversation and see photos at WUWM.com.